I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Social workers believe several thousand young people are homeless in Maryland. But who are they? Where are they? Why are they homeless? In this hour of the show, we'll hear about a census that's about to launch to get better information about people 24 and younger who have no home, family, or guardian. Also this hour, John Davis, host of Public Television's Motor Week, joins us to talk about the Volkswagen scandal. Jay Hancock of Kaiser Health News explains why the cost of out-of-pocket medical care keeps going up for Maryland workers. And Joanna Sullivan of the Baltimore Business Journal tells us about a downtown office tower that's just been put up for sale by Baltimore's wealthiest bread baker. Midday Friday begins after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks for making Midday part of your day again. Question for you. Did you tattoo? Oh, you have one? When did you get it and why? Were you sober at the time? Does it still hold the same meaning that it did back then? And do you have any regrets about your tattoo? Or are you one of those folks who stands on the sidewalk as an extravagantly tattooed man or woman walks by wondering, what the, right? In the second hour of the show today, body art historian Anna Felicity Friedman is going to be joining us to give us a tour of different styles of tattoos around the globe, talk about the tattoo phenomena, really. And we get the lowdown on local from Chris Keaton, founder of the Baltimore Tattoo Museum. All that ahead in the second hour of our show today. In this hour, we have lots to talk about from the news of the week. How many homeless youth are there in Maryland? That's a question volunteers will start to ask beginning Monday as they fan out across the city and other parts of the state, including Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore, to survey young people, 24 and younger, about their living status in order to compile a statewide census of youth homelessness. We'll hear about that effort later on in this hour. We'll also check in on the week's business news with Joanna Sullivan, editor of the Baltimore Business Journal. And we'll hear from John Davis, host of Maryland Public Television's popular show Motor Week, on the Volkswagen scandal, how Volkswagen engineered what looks like a major corporate disaster that was revealed this week. So we'll speak with John in a few minutes. First, we turn our attention to a report released by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Health Research and Educational Trust that showed a surge, and a lot of you will not be surprised to hear this, a surge in out-of-pocket medical costs for American workers, that is, deductibles, health care deductible costs continuing to rise for American workers. What's going on here and why? Joining us on the phone is Jay Hancock, my former colleague at the Baltimore Sun, a reporter now with the Kaiser Health News, an independent and nonprofit health care policy reporting agency who's been with us many times to help explain the Affordable Care Act as it rolled out and since then. So, Jay, thank you. Welcome back to Midday.
Hi, Dan. Good to be here.
So I say a lot of people won't be surprised because I think this is a familiar phenomenon around the country with workers raising deductibles and co-payments. This has been a way for employers to try to keep premiums in check over the years, and now it looks like it's just getting worse.
Yeah, it's continuing to go. Employers have tried, you know, a lot of people don't realize unless they think about it that employers pay a huge portion of the health care costs in this country through the employee-provided insurance that they provide. And it's pretty well known that health care costs, health spending has been rising at much faster than economic growth or inflation over the last 30 years and even more, and employers keep trying to do different things. They don't like it any better than anybody else does. In the 1990s, they tried pushing everybody into HMOs to try to control costs, to get you into these narrow networks. You couldn't go to the hospital that you wanted to. And employees sort of rebelled, and the economy was good, so employers backed off and brought back regular insurance. What they're doing now is trying to control their costs in a different way, which is shifting more costs to the employees. So there's two main components of your health insurance that you pay as an employee. One is your share of the premiums that gets taken out of your paycheck every 2 weeks, and that goes to just buy the plan, whether you seek care or not. That's to pay for your coverage, and that's been going up a little bit, although not a ton. Typically, employees are paying 25, 30, 35% of the total premium of the price that it pays, that it costs to pay for coverage. What's really changing, though, is the deductible, which is the amount of money up front that you pay when you go to seek care. So the deductible is what the patient pays before the insurance kicks in. And those of us who've been around a while are used to deductibles of, 10 years of like $500.
Right.
So, $500. Most people are going to spend more than that in a year, and I'll hit the deductible, and then the health plan will pay for it. About, 4 years ago, employers really started raising the deductibles a lot because that shifted cost to employees. It lowered the increases in the premiums that they had to pay because these plans with big deductibles naturally are cheaper for the employers that are paying for them. But it stuck this pretty large chunk of cost on the employees, and so now deductibles of $2,000, $3,000, or even $6,000 are not unusual. So just think about that. You're quote unquote covered by health insurance through your employer plan. That you have to pay for the first several thousand dollars of your care. Is that really quote unquote covered, or is that something else? And that's what we're looking at now.
It could be that high for some people. The average that the Kaiser Family Foundation and the Health Research and Ed Trust found, the average deductible was now $1,077. It was $303 in 2006.
Yeah, and that's for single coverage. The deductibles for family coverage is more, I think, unless I'm mistaken. It seems to, the average deductible seems to go up about $100 a year. Hmm. And the lift-out statistic from the Kaiser study was that deductibles have risen six times faster than worker incomes over that period since 2010. And everybody knows that, wages are flat. Nobody's getting raises. And yet what you're liable for your health costs is just, going up a ton more. That is a big, big burden on employees. It's also one of the sort of emerging questions about healthcare reform, because it's not just employer coverage that is subject to these large deductibles. The individual plans that are bought through the healthcare exchanges, the insurance exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act, those are also typically coming with very high deductibles. And so now the coverage has sort of expanded. The ACA has, put, give or take, 18 million extra people under health insurance. Now everybody's saying, all right, we're covered, but, geez, it's expensive.
Well, okay, so a question would be premium versus deductible. Okay, so I pay more in deductible under a policy that I choose through my employer. Say my employer gives me two or three choices. I pick one that has a $1,000 per person deductible. But in terms of how that influences my premium, is it a wash over the course of a year?
It's not. Generally, the higher the deductible, the lower the premium. But that doesn't keep premiums from going up from year to year.
No.
The survey found that even with higher deductibles from 2014 to 2015, premiums still went up about 4%, which in the history of healthcare increases is not a whole lot. But it's still something.
Mm-hmm.
And so your you know, these higher deductibles are not shielding you from higher costs elsewhere. And as I noted before, at the same time, employers are also shifting, not to as great of an extent, but they're shifting, they're making employees shoulder more shares of the premium cost as well. Generally, these high deductible plans, which, by the way, we used to call catastrophic plans, they used to be sort of looked down on as inferior coverage, and now they're becoming normal. They typically come with a health savings account or a health reimbursement account where the employee can set aside pre-tax dollars, kind of like a 401k defined contribution pension plan. You put pre-tax dollars in this account, and then you use them to pay for your health care. That is almost always comes along with these high deductible accounts. So they are tax advantaged. You're not paying out in money that you've already been taxed on, but it's still expensive, and you know, people, I got to believe that it's a burden on a lot of families.
This survey by Kaiser, by the way, is the Kaiser Family Foundation. Jay Hancock is with is with Kaiser Health News. It didn't break down the deductibles by state, but apparently Maryland is no exception to this surge in deductibles in the last year or so.
No, it's really not. I mean, just, you know, the next time you in your neighborhood or the next time you go to a party, just ask anybody who's there about their health insurance. And I bet this is probably going on. Maryland, you know, tends to track the country in these things. And the policies bought on Maryland Health Connection through the online marketplace are also going to be the same. Typically, the most popular plans in the health exchanges are silver plans or bronze plans. And the typical, you know, this is true in Maryland as elsewhere, and I don't have the exact figures for Maryland, but nationally, the average deductible for a bronze plan is around $6,000. And the average deductible for a silver plan, which are really the most popular, I think, is around close to $3,000. So you're paying hundreds of dollars a month for health insurance, and then you get sick and you have more upfront costs. All that having been said, you are covered for, you know, really expensive catastrophic costs in a way that you weren't before if you're covered in the exchange. A lot of folks that are getting coverage there didn't have any coverage before, and now they're shielded from, you know, basically bankruptcy. If something bad happens, they get cancer, they get hit by a car. And, you know, that is still substantial coverage. It still means something if you're an employee. If you have employer-sponsored coverage, the Affordable Care Act limits what your out-of-pocket costs can be, deductible of some of these plans with thinner benefits. And so that's, you know, that's not to be scoffed at. Yes, it's a burden to hit these upfront costs, but in the worst case scenario, you've got this floor under you that's protecting you.
Hey Jay, one last question. We need to be brief. I'm sorry, but would this be happening anyway if Congress hadn't 5 years ago passed the Affordable Care Act?
A lot of people I talk to think so. If anything, I mean, a lot of people credit the ACA for restraining costs. Even so, costs have been going up at a rate more than employers are comfortable with, and they were starting these high deductible things even before Obamacare got passed. So the answer is more or less yes.
Jay, thanks for spending some time with us on this today. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Yep.
Thanks, Dan.
Jay Hancock, reporter for Kaiser Health News. We have to take a break. When we get back on the other side of the news, we'd like to hear from Volkswagen owners in Maryland, because we're going to be talking with John Davis of Maryland Public Television and PBS's Motor Week about this scandal with the German automaker Volkswagen. So that's coming up after a short break. You can reach us at 410-662-8780 after this break if you have comments or questions for John Davis about the Volkswagen story. 410-662-8780. It has been announced that next Friday's Midday will be my last as host of the show. I've had a very rewarding 7.5 years here, a really nice 7.5-year run between 12 and 2 p.m. weekdays, and I'm very grateful to the station and to you, the Midday listeners, for your support of the program. And as I return to the ranks of mere WYPR listener, I shouldn't say mere, but WYPR listener and not employee, I will continue to support the valuable news and information that emanates from this place on North Charles Street in Baltimore, and I hope you will too. That was my point. Here are Andy Bienstock and Maryland Morning host Sheila Cass to tell you how to become or remain a member of WYPR. One of our listeners, Kim, on her BlackBerry 10 smartphone writes, "Our family just joined Evergreen Health Insurance Cooperative, healthcare company created by Dr. Peter Bielenson, Baltimore's former health commissioner and former health officer for Howard County. It is 20% less than our past Blue Cross Blue Shield and has better benefits." Our email address here, midday@wypr.org, if you have any comments to share with our listeners about this particular subject, the Volkswagen scandal. According to a notice of violation filed by the Environmental Protection Agency on September 18th, that was a week ago, Volkswagen installed what is known as a defeat device in vehicles equipped with 2-liter diesel engines that made it appear to meet emissions standards. The software installed in the cars very likely resulted in a violation of the Clean Air Act by avoiding testing requirements for automobiles and providing false information to obtain a certificate of conformity required to sell cars in these United States. This problem that was revealed, or this deceit that was revealed, affects some 11 million cars. The chairman of Volkswagen resigned this week. It's a big mess. John Davis, creator and host of public television's Motor Week, joining us by phone today to talk a little bit about this. John, you must be shaking your head all week long at this story, huh?
Unbelievable. Here we go. In the 80s, GM basically built lousy diesels for passenger cars and pretty much killed all the enthusiasm for them. And here we are in the 21st century, and Volkswagen has basically done it again. Only this time, I think it wasn't incompetence. It was just pure deceit. You use the word mess. I think that's the best word I can think of. And this is like an onion. We're going to, every day for quite a while, coming, going from here forward, we're going to be peeling back more layers of this. And I think a lot of people are going to be implicated before it's all over.
I go to why, so that sounds like a naive question, but I have to wonder why.
It's not a naive question. Volkswagen set out to become the world's largest automaker. They couldn't learn from GM and Toyota that had already stumbled doing that. So they wanted to do that. They couldn't do it without becoming much bigger in the U.S. They figured that there was an appetite in the U.S. for well-performing cars that were environmentally clean and got great fuel economy. They came up with, along with other German automakers, but they were the spearhead of this whole clean diesel concept, a 45, 50 mile per gallon car that didn't pollute. It was still fun to drive. It wasn't like a hybrid that would feel like you were basically driving a battery pack. They sold it to us. All the journalists in the country pretty much got on board. We certainly did. Awards went, you know, just everywhere, Green Car of the Year, et cetera. And here we find out that not only was the public duped and the government duped, but obviously all the professionals that test these cars, we were too. We all bought into the Kool-Aid.
I've heard people this week express this anger, Americans saying, you know, I bought a Volkswagen for this very reason. It's sort of like you put up a windmill to create an alternative energy source and you find out that 6 hours a day it's running on electricity or something, that the wind isn't even blowing. It's something strange like that.
Well, yeah, they were, you know, the U.S., I should say, first of all, we should say to everybody that's got these cars are not unsafe to drive it unless you're going to breathe the fumes that they cause, which is a concern to anywhere where smog's an issue or people have asthma. But the cars themselves haven't killed anybody. They basically, that we know of anyway. They basically are safe to drive. They're fun to drive. But when you really get down to it, they were just deceitful. They were the first to come out with small diesel engines that really didn't pollute, so they said. They didn't have to use some of the extra hardware that other manufacturers have had to make the diesels pass standards. There's no injection of urea into the exhaust except in some of their very newest ones. So it looked like, hey, we all bought the fact. They said, hey, our engines are smaller than most of the rivals. Therefore, we've come up with ways to meet the standards without all the extra hardware that's necessary. And it turned out to be a lie.
One of the things you wonder about here is the effect of all this on Volkswagen as a company, its financial strength. And since we're talking about new technologies, how does this affect its ability to invest in technologies in the future, you know, more fuel efficiency, better cars?
Well, you know, certainly buyer beware is always a good thing. I mean, they've lost, 40% of their stock price already.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be huge lawsuits in Germany from shareholders. Whenever new technology comes out, you always have to be a little skeptical, but diesels weren't exactly new technology. And this company had a long history of providing fun-to-drive diesels in this country. So this was not new. They walked away from the market for a few years, ostensibly while they got their act together, because we instituted much more stringent diesel emissions here. But when they came back, it just seemed like a natural progression. They picked up. They figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
They were a leader in diesels before, and here we go again. And the fact is they came back to the market prematurely, and they did it because they figured out how to rig the system.
There could be criminal charges in this.
There should be criminal charges.
John Davis,
personal opinion.
Thank you very much for joining us, John. Nice to have you on the show again.
Thanks, Dan.
Yep.
I appreciate you making the time one more time.
John Davis, host of the popular Maryland Public Television produced show for PBS Motor Week. Now we'll take a little switch here and talk to Joanna Sullivan of the Baltimore Business Journal. With the weekly business report. Joanna, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Dan.
A couple of complicated things here to talk about, but first an easy one. We'll go to the 24-story Legg Mason Tower building in Harbor East, owned by John Patarakis and his H&S Properties Development Corporation. Of course, the bakery magnet, H&S bakery magnet, John Patarakis. So that tower's there. It's one of the premier towers over there in Harbor East. It's up for sale.
It is. It's a signature building. It has some really prominent tenants, obviously Legg Mason. You can see it from all over the city. One Main Financial, John Hopkins, Carey Business School. It has the Anthropologie store, the Under Armour retail store. It is 97% leased, which is really good, and it's on the market. So it just shows you, you know, we've been seeing a lot more buildings up for sale. Other, you know, companies have been interested in buildings in downtown Baltimore. So the commercial real estate market's really coming back.
Now, here's a story. It takes a little bit to explain. BG&E in Baltimore City, BG&E has these underground systems, right? Underground.
The city owns the conduit underneath
right.
the ground.
Right.
And it's aging infrastructure, and the city wants to basically charge a whole lot more to BGE. Right now they're paying about 98 cents per foot, and they just passed regulation that they would be paying $3.33 per foot. So BGE is saying, we're going to pass it on to the customers. The city's saying, that's not fair. Jack Young said, you've raised rates four times. So it's definitely a battle to watch. It affects businesses' wallets,
yeah.
people, residents' wallets. It affects all of our wallets. There's a bigger issue as well. You know, broadband internet access is not great in the city, and the conduit could be a way for us to really expand that broadband access. And, you know, I've talked to people who said the city should not sell it. BGE tried to buy the conduit for $100 million. It's probably worth a lot more, and this could affect, you know, internet access, which is a huge problem in the city. You know, how fast we can get our internet to our homes and our businesses.
I'm glad you mentioned that angle, but this is an interesting development here. The city's this vast underground conduit system. The city hasn't been really doesn't sound like they've been charging that much, but anyway, they voted to more than triple the rate. that BGE pays them. BGE says, we're going to pass it along to the consumers. City Council President Jack Young says, we're going to fight you at the Public Service Commission over that. So this will be an interesting story to follow for a while.
I think it's not going to go away, and people should stay on top of it because, you know what your bills are like these days.
Mm-hmm.
They could go even higher.
Now we'll switch over to the west side for one more story here. Over at the University of Maryland Baltimore Biopark, just on the other side of Martin Luther King Boulevard, another office building going in there, a 250,000 square foot office and lab building. But the developer wants a TIF in Baltimore. There's a TIF for that. That's called, a TIF is short for tax increment financing bonds. And Joanna, we've heard about these before.
We have, and not for a little while. You know, we heard the big controversy over the Exelon headquarters and Michael Beatty getting a TIF and all the commotion that caused. So it was a surprise to see another one come in. So, we're following that. You know, they want Wexford Science and Technology wants to build an 8-story building there. That biopark has been, growing, but, not as fast as, we expected years ago. It's a huge building, so it would be, it'd be a big addition over there on the
mm-hmm.
west side.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's up to the city council whether or not, they will approve this TIF.
Well, they're requesting $17 million in TIF.
$17 million, yeah. And the project would also need state approval. So this could become a point of, contention. The mayor has been criticized in the past for being too cozy with developers with TIFs. So, this could be an issue.
And you got
in her last.
It's the city council too, Joanna. They have to vote on this, and they're all up
yes.
for a re-election. Most of them in next spring. Hey, what's on the cover of the BBJ this week?
Well, this week we went to Harford County and we did a spotlight on Harford County, and our main story is about how Harford County is really coming out of the shadow of APG, the new county executive. Glassman does not want to be so reliant on Aberdeen Proving Ground. It's their biggest employer, but he would like to diversify the economy, attract more technology companies, and attract more residents. They did not get as many residents as they expected with the Pentagon closing a base in New Jersey. They thought they would be getting a lot more. So they're going after empty nesters and families, of course, but even millennials, which they're trying to make Harford County more fun, more restaurants, more local restaurants, and more shopping. So stay tuned. Harford County could become the next Canton.
We'll see. A reference there to the county executive, Barry Glassman, and the cover story of this week's Baltimore Business Journal. In print today on Fridays, Joanna Sullivan, editor of the BBJ. Thank you very much for being with us, Joanne.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
We'll take another break here on Midday. When we come back on the other side, we'll talk about our key story, our main story today, about homeless youth in Maryland and a census that's going to be launched next week to try to figure out how many young people, 24 and younger, are without home, family, or guardian. That's coming up after this break here on the Friday Midday Show. We ask you to make a pledge, make a donation to WYPR to keep us rolling along here, your public radio. Here's Andy Beanstalk and Sheila Cast once again. Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch today said that the state will be investigating deceptive emissions mechanisms in Volkswagen diesel vehicles and will examine ways to compensate vehicle owners and protect against future environmental harm, with Maryland joining in with 28 other states, at least 28 other states, investigating Volkswagen. A statement from Attorney General Frosch said, "I am furious that the world's leading car company willfully took steps that polluted our environment and deceived consumers. I share the anger of those who put their trust in this company and its promises. We will fight aggressively for the best possible outcome for Marylanders." On Monday's Midday Show, the tech-savvy Sean Gallagher, editor of Ars Technica, based here in Baltimore, will be joining us to talk about a couple of things. And one of them is the software that made the Volkswagen emissions deceit possible. Sean will be on the show in the noon hour. Monday, we'll also be talking about a very interesting story from the Tribune News Service yesterday about flaws in those two big Army blimps that you can see in the sky to the east of Baltimore, over on the southeast side of Baltimore County and up to Harford County. So we'll be talking about that with Sean in the first hour. And in the second hour on Monday, a Johns Hopkins researcher finds that 1.5 million American households are now living on $2 per day per person, a comprehensive study of poverty in this country in a book called $2 a Day. That'll be on Monday's show. In this segment of the show, we want to talk about homelessness in Maryland, specifically homelessness among young people, that is people, boys and girls, men and women, 24 and younger, who have no home, no guardian or family. There's a census coming up to try to account for this and figure out how many of these individuals live in our state. So joining us today to talk about this is Delegate Mary Washington, a Democrat who represents the 43rd District here in Baltimore City. Delegate Washington, nice to see you again.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Ryan Shanahan is with us. Ryan Shanahan is Project Director for Youth Reach Maryland. Youth Reach Maryland will be conducting this census starting on Monday, right, Ryan?
That's correct.
So thank you for being here as well. So you're going to look at Baltimore City, Annapolis, Anne Arundel County, Baltimore County, and then out to the west, Hagerstown, Washington County, then down to Prince George's County, and also looking at three Eastern Shore counties, Somerset, Wicomico, and Worcester, right?
Yep. And that was a part of the legislation that we drafted to ensure to both fund and to allocate the Youth Reach Maryland project as a demonstration project. And what we wanted to do is to get a sense. Right now we have anecdotal information about how many unaccompanied homeless youth there are. We have some counts based on school-based counts that are required under federal HUD requirements and McKinty-Vinto. But through...
What's that?
I will tell you. It's the most comprehensive federal legislation that we passed some decades ago around how we can improve and end homelessness in our country. And so local jurisdictions, local school systems are required to give numbers. And so we have some numbers, but we know that homelessness for young people, they aren't just in schools. We know that they are all through, that they are in rural areas as well as across in urban areas. And we wanted to have a sampling that was based on, you know, the center of Maryland, but also address Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore.
So Youth Reach Maryland is just the name of this project? Is that a nonprofit that's been in place for a while?
I can tell you how it was formed. It actually came out of the work of a task force on unaccompanied homeless youth that was passed in the legislature about 2 years ago. I was approached by a group of young people from the Yes Drop-In Center that's located actually right down the street from you, mm-hmm. And the Homeless Persons Representation Project, and they wanted a bond bill. And so we decided instead to begin to look more broadly about the issues of, well, how is it that young people are finding themselves needing transitional housing. And so we passed a task force and got a lot of different agencies and nonprofits on board. We studied it for about a year. And one of the recommendations from the task force was to conduct a demonstration project. And so we, as the legislature, passed that project. It was funded through supplemental allocation under Martin O'Malley, and then it was funded again under the Hogan administration. And the Department of Housing and Community Development are the ones who are managing the project. And so the coordinating entity is Ryan at the University of Maryland School of Social Work.
Ryan, how are you going to do this?
So we are, it's going to be a combination of shelter and street counts. We're going out in the communities with surveys to identify hotspots where youth are known to congregate. The survey is being administered by six different regions in Maryland, which we talked about. And they are using a combination of street outreach, shelter counts. They're engaging service providers who are known to encounter homeless youth. And they could be sending teams of volunteers that consist of youth themselves armed with a survey out in the community to find homeless youth and have them complete a survey to count them.
How accurate or complete have the school counts been?
Well, we know. I'll give you an example. About 3 years ago, the Department of Housing and Community Development did a special population count of veterans. And we had some regions, it was on the Eastern Shore, and you had regions that were reporting about nine
veterans homeless.
Yeah. But then we did a targeted, funded through the Department of Housing and Community Development, a targeted approach, and they found hundreds more. And so we're thinking that that might be similar. At any point in time, there may be 3,000 or more people, say in Baltimore City, who don't have a place to sleep at night.
Who are 24 and younger?
No, so some proportion of that 3,000
are in
just
school.
In Baltimore City are young people who are unaccompanied.
Are of school age?
Yeah, who are between the ages, who are younger than 24.
So I just want to get that. That's interesting. So the school count, you might have a partial school count.
Right.
But that may not be complete.
Right.
And then it doesn't account for kids who are not school age anymore, right?
Right.
Who theoretically have graduated.
Right. So this captures the population of youth that are 24 or younger. So these could be youth who have dropped out. These could be youth who are, you know, at this transition stage in life who are not in any kind of school. So
how do you get to be homeless when you're 20 or 21? Can we just talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
That's what I really want to get at. Because a lot of people listening right now are wondering, really? I mean, thousands of kids, meaning kids, 24
yes,
and younger.
There are many young people who are managing through life on their own. And some are leaving violent situations in their home. Some are not accepted for they have parents who have their own struggles and are not able to support them. We found that through the task force, some of our policies in terms of even providing shelter for homeless people, if you have families, some private shelters won't accept young people over the age of 16, won't accept males over 16. So you have families trying to make the decision, well, do I get temporary housing for myself and my younger children, and my older child leaves, is out there on their own. And so the other thing we found out through some of our research was that our own foster care system was contributing to unstably housing young people. In other words, you leave the system when you're 18 and then you're on your own. I don't know if you remember. I remember when I was 18, I relied a lot from the ages of 18 to 24 on other adults to support me.
Right.
And we are those other adults for those young people. And the state of Maryland wants to take responsibility and support young people. And the only way for us to do that is to get a good count of who they are, but not only the number, but what are some of their challenges. And that's what's great about the survey, that I guess Ryan could tell you a little bit about what's on the survey, so that we do strongly believe that it'll help us develop better programs and policies for them.
16,000. So I want to ask you about this number. I see the number, an estimated 16,000 homeless youth in Maryland, defined as 24 and younger, without home, family, or guardianship. And just wonder, how do you get to that number? That's an estimate, and I guess the census will tell you whether that's accurate or not.
I'd just like to make a correction that the 16,000 figure is what the schools report, and these may not necessarily be unaccompanied youth. These are all homeless youth who they may be residing with their families. We know from national research.
Excuse me. They may be residing with their families?
So they may be homeless, but in the guardianship of their families. I'm sorry. So, or in the custody or care of their families.
But not living with their families.
Right. So we know.
Okay, so what are you correcting? I just wonder where that estimate came from. That's all.
It's students under the age of 18 are homeless.
Okay, that's just under the age of 18.
Right.
Okay. And that's based on the school count.
Yes.
Right.
And that's what you think is partial.
Yeah. We believe that's an undercount. So, again, these are young people who are in school, and it's under the age of 18, and they may be in families that are experiencing homelessness. We may pick up some additional children in this count of those children, but we're particularly interested in those who are managing out there on their own. So they're not in our foster care system. They've managed to not get arrested. They've managed to, on a day-to-day, find. Now, sometimes they're on a couch. Sometimes they're sleeping with a family temporarily. Sometimes they're sleeping in tents, and we just want to know the full range of their experiences.
You're going to do this over 2 weeks, Ryan?
That's correct.
Well, good luck to you, and come back and report to us, would you?
Absolutely.
All right. Ryan Shanahan, who's a graduate of the University of Maryland School of Social Work, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Conducting this study, leading the study, Youth Reach Maryland, and Delegate Mary Washington. Thank you for coming in to explain all this to you, to us, and good luck with this.
It's my pleasure.
And that's our first hour of Midday today. That's Midday Friday. We have another hour ahead for you, so please stay tuned. I want to thank Joe Squared Pizza. Joe Squared, located at 133 West North Avenue in the Station North neighborhood, provides lunch for our guests every Friday here on the Midday Show. They also have locations at the Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live, and you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. They're moving to a new location on North Avenue and across from Red Emma's. What is that? North Avenue and Howard Street? North Howard and no, Maryland Avenue. Yeah, thank you very much. But that's happening. That's imminent. Joe Squared Pizza. Anyway, thank you, everybody. Stay tuned. We got another hour of Midday ahead. We're going to talk about tattoos in the second hour of our show today. Right now, Andy Beanstalk and Sheila Cass standing by to tell you how you can become or remain a member of WYPR.